Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 17 of Mike Check on Sports. I'm Steve Napolitani. Some positive news announced recently that NASCAR will be returning to the track again on May 17th. Whether you are a NASCAR fan or not, it's a good sign for sports. In a continuing effort to recognize small businesses at this time, I'd like to dedicate this episode to Elysian Cafe in Hoboken, New Jersey. My next guest is one of ESPN's top play-by-play guys for college football and college basketball, and he is the voice of the New York Jets. It's Bob Ashusen. Bob, thanks for coming on.
No problem, Stevie. How are you?
I'm doing okay, and you know, I know we're all going through a tough time here, and I know you aren't busy calling games, but I know your wife, Julie, is a volunteer frontline worker. You know, how's that been for your family?
It was a little scary at first, I have to say. You know, she being a nurse that doesn't have a full-time job, and another good friend of ours that lives around the corner is a real good friend, is a school nurse. So they're both RNs, both without regular gigs right now, but both know a lot of people that are in hospitals, you know, up to their neck every day in this crisis. And they just felt guilty. They felt like they needed to go do something. So they got in touch with the Medical Reserve Corps and volunteered. So they both go to the Kane University drive-up testing site, which is only about 15 minutes, 20 minutes away from our house. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I mean, they are there just the way you see on TV. The National Guard is running it. They've got tents. They're swabbing people as they drive through and conducting hundreds of tests a day. And, you know, she said it's starting to slow down a little bit, but not as much as you would think. There's still a lot of people coming in to get tested on a pretty regular basis, which hopefully is a good sign that the testing capacity is continuing to expand. But, you know, we were scared when she first went. Mm-hmm. We didn't know what she was walking into. But then I have to tell you, she talks about how safe she feels.
Oh, that's great.
She thinks the people have done an amazing job of getting this thing up and running, and the National Guard running it. And, you know, I mean, she is under, you know, five layers of protection, it seems, with a face shield and the whole nine. So, yeah, she feels, I think, more exposed when we go to the supermarket than she does when she's there.
Wow. And you haven't, you know, you've been involved too. You've been raising money, delivering food to hospitals and testing sites. What kind of prompted you to do that?
I felt like a jerk because she was going to this drive-up testing site, and what am I doing? I'm sitting home eating ham and cheese sandwiches, so I felt like I should do something. And it was easy. I mean, it's two phone calls, basically.
Right.
You know, we know enough people that are working at hospitals that I can call someone on the inside and say, hey, how about a food delivery? And every restaurant that's still open is dying for anyone to give them a takeout order.
Right.
So to get it's two phone calls. It's pretty easy. I did a GoFundMe, and people have been nice enough to donate about $10,000, and I've probably gone through 7,000 or 8,000 of it. So I still have some money left over, and I'm going to do a few more. As long as there's enough money to, you know, spend $700 or $800 on hamburgers, then I'll bring 50 hamburgers to a hospital and drop them off. It's a pretty easy thing to do.
Nice. Well, you grew up in Central New Jersey. How much were sports a part of your life at a young age? And did you always know you wanted to go into sports broadcasting?
Yeah. I have no idea why. When I was a kid, I could tell you who all of the broadcasters were for all the teams I rooted for, as much as I could tell you who the players on the teams were. But I was just always drawn to that. I also feel like I probably recognized in myself at a much earlier age than most people that I had no chance to be an athlete. So, you know, if I wanted to be involved in sports, then being the loud, annoying guy screaming about them is probably my best bet. And so, yeah, it was a pretty natural choice.
And who were some of your broadcast influences?
Well, I mean, all the guys you listened to growing up, you know, and it's such a variety if you're in New York.
Right.
You know, like you got the Phil Rizzuto, Bill White, Frank Messer, Yankee Booth, which could not have been more eclectic. I mean, you know, Scooter was a personality unto himself. But then, you know, listen to Jim Karvelas call the Knicks on the radio, and Marv, and, you know, Jim Gordon was the Giant radio announcer and did the Rangers. You know, just all of the, you know, the voices of my youth probably had a little bit of an influence on me. You know, it was an amazing time to grow up in New York from a broadcasting standpoint, because while you had, you know, the Scooters of the world that were really just all personality, you also had like the Bob Murphys and the Marty Glickmans. And, you know, I barely remember Lindsay Nelson. I mean, some of the really tried and true just hardcore nuts and bolts classic play-by-play guys that, you know, see, you heard kind of every little slice of it, how to do it technically as well as you can do it, but also guys that would weave personality into it and have that work a lot as well.
Hmm. Then you ended up going to Boston College, which a lot of people would say is not really known as a TV school, like a Syracuse or something like that. What went into that decision?
I don't know. No. I have no idea. Yeah. I mean, it was like I went to a Catholic high school. BC is probably, I mean, it's certainly not Ivy League, nor did I want Ivy League. I'm not that smart, and I didn't want that kind of pressure. But, you know, good education, 4 hours away, Boston, great city. And, you know, when I first went there, I didn't really know, other than the fact that they had a student radio station, what the advantage was going to be to going there. But what it turned out to be was being in Boston and then getting internships.
Gotcha.
I mean, that's like all the guys that go to Syracuse, God bless them. It's a great program. And, you know, it's not hard to see the success of those that have gone to Syracuse, you know, what it means to be someone who, you know, graduates from that program to your career. But the thing that got me my start was being an intern. And I don't know if you're in Syracuse, you know, how deep the internship opportunities are. When you're in Boston and New York City, the way I was during the school year and then in the summertime. So I was an intern at the all sports radio stations in major markets, you know, WEEI up there and FAN in New York. And I mean, that's how I got my start, interning for those guys and then having those guys, when I graduated, make a call on my behalf to get me a job.
Right. And then your first job was in Miami, but then you came back to New York and started working at WFAN. I mean, how big was getting a job at WFAN?
It was great. It was, and again, it was all based on the internship. Because I ran into a program director in Miami that just was not a fan of mine. You know, very subjective business. He didn't think I was very good at it. And he took me off the air and put himself on. And I realized, all right, well, I got to get out of here. And I sent tapes and resumes all over the country. And I had nibbles. You know, you spend a couple of years in Miami before Lauderdale. Then I remember, you know, program director in Cleveland thought he might have something for me. And Seattle and Las Vegas, whatever. And so I remember getting in touch with, you know, Eric Spitz, my old boss, who I interned for at FAN, and I'm bouncing all of these possibilities off of him, and he's like, what are you doing? And so I need a job. What do you mean, what am I doing? Like, I got to get out of here. This guy doesn't like me. I'm buried on doing afternoon updates. I used to be on morning drive radio. Like, I got to get out. So why don't you just come back here and work for us? And I was like, I didn't even know that was possible. And he said, no, yeah. You know, I mean, like, there might be weeks where I can only use you twice. There might be weeks where I can give you 9 shifts in 7 days. But at the very least, if you come back here and you're living at home and you're not paying rent, and, you know, then we could kind of work you up towards being a regular member of the radio station. And I was like, well, that's where I always wanted to be in the first place. I mean, I wanted to be in New York at FAN. That's who wouldn't want to be there if you were a New York sports kid growing up in the 80s. And so it just worked out. I kind of came back as a jack of all trades. You know, Spitzy would have update shifts and send me out to some games and weekend hosting, some overnights, whatever it was. And do any shift he offered, I never said no. And that was it. I just I kind of grew into a role at FAN and stayed there for about 6 years.
And then you got to do some play-by-play with Comcast, doing some high school and college games. Like you said earlier, play-by-play has always been the ultimate goal for you.
You know, it really wasn't. If you would have asked me what I wanted to be when I was in high school, I would have said Art Russ Jr. You know, I would have said that I wanted to be a guy taking telephone calls, screaming and yelling, maybe a la Mike and the Mad Dog, about sports 4 or 5 hours a day. What could be better than that? But then when you're in the talk business, you know, I mean, there is a little bit of a beating a dead horse over and over and over again element to it. I miss it a lot, I have to admit, and you kind of have to choose either or. It's very hard to be a talk show host and a play-by-play guy. I mean, Michael Kay does it, but there really aren't any others that do it.
Right.
So it is kind of hard to find that happy place and do both. And, you know, when I was at FAN, I wasn't really considered for any of the big talk show host jobs. I mean, the lineup changed there multiple times, and I never got promoted. And, you know, branching off into play-by-play became something that, you know, was a lot of fun. It's allowed me to travel the country. I've been to 46 of the 50 states. You know, I've seen, you know, a lot of the places that people only get a chance to see on television, I've seen most, if not all of them, in person. And the games were a blast. I mean, it's, you know, it is a lot of fun to be at the event sometimes than sitting in a studio waiting for the event to be over.
Right. How's that preparation different for you?
It depends on the sport.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're a talk show host, you have to have kind of your thumb on everything.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a play-by-play guy, you definitely kind of get in a silo to a certain extent, and you really are focusing on your game. College football is really the only one that's really hard. I mean, the, you know, unless you've prepared to do a college football game, you really, in our business, even don't understand what it is to really prepare. Because you've got such an army of players that could factor in the game.
Right.
There's just a million guys. And, you know, it does take a decent amount of work. But it's a labor of love, because at the end of the week, when you're, you know, at Auburn, and you're calling Auburn Texas A&M, and there's 95,000 people there, and it's what they live for, and you can, it's palpable, you can feel that. You know, it's a lot of fun.
One thing I never really asked anybody, I just kind of thought of this, as far as the preparation is concerned, you do pro sports, you do college sports. As far as materials and research materials and what's made available to you, what's the difference between college and pro?
It really is no difference. It's almost the difference between, it's team to team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I know you've produced and dealt with a lot of different teams at the pro level, NHL and whatnot. Sometimes you're going to get a set of game notes that have more information in them than you could possibly ever hope to digest. Sometimes you get a set of game notes and you're like, oh, well, the guy that wrote these mailed it in. He didn't give me anything.
Right.
And that's no different in college or the NFL. I mean, sometimes you're getting a set of game notes and a, you know, package of articles and tapes in the mail. And, you know, you're like, wow, this guy really invested his time. He wants to tell the story of his team. He wants you to have the right information. He knows how to categorize it. He knows the way you have to prepare. And sometimes you're going to get a set of game notes where all the, you know, the guy in charge of putting them together does is, you know, recap the last three games and throws a couple of bullet points in there, and you could tell he did it in about 10 minutes. So, you know, there's really not a lot of difference college to pro where that's concerned. It's, you know, it is something that just kind of varies school to school, team to team.
Gotcha. And then in 2001, you joined MSG Networks with the Fox Sports Regional Sports Report. What made you come to that decision? And you were doing this, the play-by-play stuff of college, but this was more of a studio gig again and kind of a little different thing you've done.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of twofold. Well, threefold, really. Boss at FAN, the ultimate boss there, was, I could tell, as a talk show host, not really a big fan of mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he was... I was forever to him going to be the guy that filled in on weekends and at night.
Right.
I was never going to be considered for a regular day part. So if you're not going to have a chance to move up, now here's someone, it was Mike McCarthy, obviously. We all worked for at MSG at the time. Mike was offering kind of a two-pronged job. He was offering, a chance to be on television every night
mm-hmm.
and get that experience. So kind of a local version of SportsCenter where, you know, you're in front of a camera. You're dealing with a teleprompter. You're dealing with shot sheets. You're dealing with producers that are running you stuff in last minute, and you know, obviously TV is its own art form. And I was also immediately made like the backup play-by-play guy for the Rangers. So I would get 25 Ranger games a year, you know, maybe 20 to 22 on radio, and yeah, even 3 or 4 on television from time to time. I'd fill in when Kenny Albert and Sam Rosen both couldn't make it, you know, to a weekend Ranger game. I'd even get bumped up to TV.
Right.
And you know, that even evolved into being one of the backup guys doing 8 or 10 Knicks games a year at one point. So, you know, the combination of expanding the portfolio to being comfortable on television and also to being given an opportunity to do play-by-play for the Knicks and Rangers in whatever capacity, you know, 30, 35 games a year, whatever it kind of added up to at the end of the year, that was a really nice option rather than just spinning my wheels at FAN and not really going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the other thing too was the connection with the Jets, which I've maintained. The Jets were on FAN for a long time. And then MSG kind of swooped in at the midnight hour when the Jet contract was up at FAN. I was still only the pre and post game host. I wasn't the play-by-play guy. But MSG took the Jets from FAN. And so any chance I had to continue my affiliation with the Jets, even as the pre and post game host, mm-hmm. was to go over to the Garden and do that as well on the weekends. So all of that combined just made it, I think, the right move. And, I've never regretted it.
I remember you and Bill Daughtry doing almost like one of those first radio TV shows with Talk of Our Town.
Yeah, that's I've kind of blocked that out, but thanks for bringing that up. Well, that came from Mike and the Mad Dog going on Yes.
Right.
I mean, that was, I think we thought at MSG that they were going to do that show on our air, if memory serves.
Right.
And then they struck a deal with Yes to go over to Yes. And all of a sudden, our guys were like, well, if we're going to be a 24-hour-a-day channel, the way it seems like Yes is basically going to be, but putting these guys on for 5 hours a day, we have to put something on in the afternoon.
Right.
And put the two of us on in the afternoon as a television-only talk show to balance out those two guys. And I don't know how much we balanced them out. I would say for every 20 guys that were watching their show, maybe one was watching ours. But I don't know. We were on. We talked sports. We had fun.
But then in 2002, you're named the voice of the Jets, play-by-play. Was that the dream come true moment for you?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you get a chance to be the voice of a team you grew up rooting for, you know, what would not be awesome about that?
Right.
And it's true, you know, all of the years that I've done that, I have to admit, you know, it's not even the ability to do the games. It's really the people that I've met and the people I've worked with, you know, getting to know Marty Lyons, getting to know all the guys on our crew, all the people that work for the team. I've got friends for life that I wouldn't have had if it had not been for that job.
Right. And then in 2006, you started calling games for ESPN. And I remember one time you were on the road with the Rangers and we were sitting at dinner and you're showing me pictures of these small airports and these small college towns you were working at, bouncing from all these small conferences.
When you first start at ESPN, and I want to say, if ESPNU wasn't a complete newborn, it was in its infancy when I began at ESPN. So, like, they were looking to find guys to go do – I remember one of the games I did – for ESPNU was Tennessee Tech at Tennessee Martin.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to talk about in the middle of nowhere. You fly into Memphis and you still have an hour and a half drive in front of you to like up in the middle of nowhere. I remember going to the practice for Tennessee Martin the day before the game. And you know, you got your little ESPN golf shirt on and whatnot. And the coach for Tennessee Martin comes walking over to me, sticks out his right hand and goes, "Who'd you piss off?" And I was like, "Coach, come on." I'm like, "I'm excited to be here. Come on, ESPN, college basketball." He's like, "Come on, Tennessee Tech, Tennessee Martin, how'd you get this game?" I'm like, "This is your team."
Right.
So, yeah, so we had a laugh. I mean, he was obviously saying it with a smile on his face. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, ESPN in this pandemic lost about 1,700 live events just overnight. It all went away. And obviously they're hoping to get a decent amount of that back at some point. Hopefully baseball and the NBA both combine to find a way to, you know, even if it's in front of just the television audience, get their seasons going again. And hopefully football, if we get a vaccine, if we get expanded testing, if we get an antiviral, if we get whatever combination of tools we need to have football in the fall, ESPN will get that back. But, I mean, you know, once you get to ESPN, you realize how much – the network still is built on the live event. All these, you know, all the talking heads, and sometimes I'm one. I mean, I do talk shows, and it's a lot of fun. But the real bread and butter of ESPN in terms of the programming, the thing that you can't replace, are the live events.
Right.
That's what draws eyeballs there initially and in the greatest numbers.
When you're sitting, and now, whether you're the Horseshoe, the Big House, Happy Valley, and you're sitting in the booth, do you ever look back and think about those days when you were at Tennessee Martin and just kind of revel in the moment where you are now?
You know, I probably should do that a lot more than I do. That would be a character flaw. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's something that, I don't know, maybe the reason that I'm sitting in a stadium with 100,000 people in it is because I don't do that.
Right.
Because I'm always grinding over how come my crew got this game, but that crew got a better game.
Right.
And so we're always, it's a very competitive business. It's ego driven. Everybody wants bigger and better and more important. So I think probably someday, Like, I actually had a moment. I think I put this on Twitter. I had a moment last winter where I did the Pinstripe Bowl and had a couple of college basketball games all kind of wrapped around the Pinstripe Bowl. And in, like, the course of 2 weeks or 2.5 weeks or something, I did a game, like, at Madison Square Garden, Allen Fieldhouse, Cameron Indoor Stadium, Yankee Stadium, and, like, Happy Valley for Penn State or something. I mean, I probably had that wrong, but it was definitely – it was one of those moments where I remember putting it on Twitter saying, you know, we all want bigger games. We all want better games. But this was a week where I probably kind of took a look back and said, that's pretty cool. I mean, I went to 5 bucket list, like, check-the-box places that any sports fan would want to be a part of all in the last 10 days and called games there. And, you know, sometimes you kind of get in the mill, the grind of what we do, and you just don't think about that.
Right.
You don't take enough time to realize that, you know, there are a lot of people out there that spend every last disposable dollar they've got to have a chance to go to one of those places.
Right.
I went to like 5 of them in 8 days or something. So, yeah, it's, you know, I probably should have more moments like that than I do. But just a competitor in me, I guess I don't.
Do you have any idea how many analysts you've worked with over the years?
No.
No.
Somebody made a list. Not of mine. I want to say it was Kenny Albert.
Yeah, Kenny spoke
to you. I think Kenny made a list, right? Does he keep a running list or something?
He has some type of list, or somebody made one. And ironically enough, just as you said his name, a text message from him popped up on my phone.
There you go.
See? That is crazy.
Between being at the Garden, between doing like Westwood games, between ESPN, like I had a stretch college football wise where I had a different analyst every year for 10 straight years. They finally put me with Brock Heward, and he ended up being my partner for like 4 seasons. But I mean, every year I had a different guy.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of one-offs too.
Right.
Sure, that's how you accumulate that list that Kenny keeps. I never kept the list, but I would say right now, even at ESPN, from a college football standpoint, I don't think there's an analyst I haven't done at least one game with. I mean, that includes Kirk Herbstreit, Todd Blackledge, you know, the guys that are kind of, you know, the top of the food chain. I've worked with those guys. College basketball?
Yeah.
Man, I don't think there's a guy outside of Walton on our roster right now that I've also failed to work with. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure if I accumulated a list, it would probably look like Kenny's. I just never did it.
Right. And how, speaking of college basketball analysts, how was it to work with Dick Vitale?
Awesome.
Awesome, yeah.
Awesome. Exactly the way you would think. You know, the thing that strikes me the most about him, I mean, he's 80 years old. He's got every bit the enthusiasm now that he did when he was first starting. It almost seems to get more energy now, which is amazing. And he's just a very real person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing that strikes me the most about him. I've said this a million times. One of the first games I worked with him, we were at Duke. And, you know, an hour before the game, you go down and sit with Krzyzewski in his office. And, you know, you get to bounce about 10 minutes of questions off of him. And after, you know, you're done with that, I mean, as Dick's play-by-play guy, you kind of have to be his caddy as well. You know what I mean? Like, he's 80 years old.
Right.
I grab the bag. I make sure he's okay getting through the door and through the crowd and everything. But we're coming out of the locker room where we've just spoken with Krzyzewski. And, you know, there's a security guard in the hallway. And he's like, Dickie V. I love Dickie V. Can I get a picture? You're the best. Now, if Dick had blown this guy off, the only 3 people in the world that would have known that he blew the guy off would have been me, Dick, and the security guard.
Right.
And no problem. We're, you know, probably have to be, he probably has to be on SportsCenter in about 3 minutes.
Right.
And he drops his bag and hands me his camera so I could take a picture of the two of them together. We could put it on Twitter and the whole thing, you know. And he just, you know, people see him all the time with a wig on dancing with the students in the student section or conducting the band and doing that whole routine.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're back in the bowels of the arena and you just run into fans and a little kid or a security guard, anybody that wants a picture with him, right. He never says that. You know, he just is always, he's never forgotten where he came from.
That's
talks
great.
About it all the time. He's just an ambassador for the game. And he's still amazed that, you know, 40 years later, they, you know, that he is where he is and that he's made a 40-year career out of this. So he's just, he is what I think we all hope to be, which is don't forget where you came from and how lucky you are to be in this business.
Yeah. And you mentioned Brock Huber before. I heard him say about you, I would challenge anyone to find another football guy in our ESPN family. There are great broadcasters, but as far as understanding the game, knowing the ins and outs, there are very few in the business that could do that. Where did your football IQ come from?
I don't know. I mean, probably more than anything, just glomming off of the guys that I've had a chance to work with. Like, one of the things that I really enjoy, I don't know how many play-by-play guys do this. In my opinion, it's part of the DNA of the job. If you're not doing it, you're not doing the job the way you ought to do the job, is getting into a film room on a Friday with your analyst and spending however many hours that guy wants to spend in there and watching tape. Because these guys prepare the good ones. Not all of them, but the good ones. Brock is a good example. Dan Orlovsky, very good example. Matt Millen was an example of this. Like, guys that I've worked with, they prepare to do one of these broadcasts very similarly to the way they prepared to do a game, to play in a game. So they watch tape, and they break the teams down the same way they would as a player and then as a broadcaster, but then being a player or a coach, they're talking about it on television the same way they would if they had a coach's clicker and they were breaking it down in a film room, scouting report, whatnot. I mean, the good ones do that. So when you spend a lot of time in a room with guys like that and you kind of get to see much more conceptually the ins and outs of the games beyond just, you know, a quarterback with a great arm slinging a ball down the sideline, you actually get to see how a play, you know, from an architecture standpoint is constructed or how a defense is able to blow up the architecture of a play. You just get a greater appreciation, a deeper appreciation for the game. And then that leads you to be able to ask better questions of your analyst on the air or call a play and maybe recognize something in the play while you're calling it that just becomes a natural segue to the analyst then talking from an X's and O's standpoint about something that you knew he wanted to talk about because you spent all that time in the film room with him and you learned the matchups that you think he's are going to be most important. And, you know, so that's probably comes more than anything from me stealing all of their information than it is like I'm some kind of a football brainiac.
Right. And it's all about preparation, you know, which leads me to the night of the NFL draft. You know, it seemed like everyone on TV or social media was calling for the Jets to take a skill guy. You, on the other hand, I was following you. You were talking about offensive linemen all the way. And then the Jets end up going with offensive lineman Mekhi Becton out of Louisville. Did you just have a hunch? What was your thoughts there?
Well, I had more than a hunch. Yeah. I mean, I knew what their priorities were.
Right.
But that also comes from, I guess, what Brock was talking about, which is when you spend all that time in a film room with these guys, you do realize, and I've worked with every single conceivable guy from every possible background. I've worked with players, coaches, offensive guys, defensive guys, you know, quarterbacks, linebackers, defensive backs, coordinators, whatever their resume was. The moment every single one of them, and I didn't realize this until I'd worked with even a handful of guys, and you realize the pattern, the moment any of them sit down in a film room, the first thing they do is turn on the tape and point at the offensive line. And, you know, they'll have like a bullet point about each guy. You know, the right guard's got great feet. The left guard's a waistbender. But, man, that left tackle's really athletic. Go on, watch this center. You know, he really is a smart guy. And he can call out blitzing patterns and whatnot. And they have a scouting report on every guy on the offensive line. And that really becomes the jumping off point for how they break the game down. Can Team A block Team B? And if they can't, then it doesn't matter how great their wide receivers and running backs are. If you can't block the other team, and I think that's kind of the culture of football, what we've gotten away from. You know, fantasy football has become such an all-encompassing thing where all we talk about is PPR and Christian McCaffrey and how many balls he catches and, you know, this wide receiver gets targeted this number of times and yards and touchdowns and blah, blah, blah. Anybody that really watches football from a coaching or playing standpoint and is involved in it that way, they all understand it's still a line of scrimmage game. It's still about whether or not you can block the other team and whether or not they can block you. And if you go back to the Jets last year, I mean, watch how many times Sam Darnold was running for his life. Watch how many times Le'Veon Bell got through the line of scrimmage before being touched. And how many times he was touched behind the line of scrimmage. Mm-hmm. Jets couldn't block the other team, but the other team could block them. And that's it. I mean, once you realize that's the jumping off point, it doesn't matter if you're drafting receivers or have a great quarterback. You know, if you're running for your life on every play and the structure of every play is blown up before you get a chance to start it because you can't block the other team, you better draft some offensive linemen. So I was pretty much, unless those top four guys were all gone, I was pretty sure where they were going to go.
And where do you see the Jets this year coming up?
Well, their schedule's going to be harder. Mm-hmm. And I know that Jet fans don't want to hear this. I wouldn't want to hear it either. But this is not a one-year fix. I mean, their roster, based on 6 or 7 consecutive years of completely, you know, unproductive drafts, is kind of laid bare of talent. So, you know, that's why if you saw Joe Douglas didn't go out and spend a bunch of money in free agency on longer term contracts. He didn't go get Amari Cooper. You know, he didn't draft 3 wide receivers this year just to try and get Sam Darnold some weapons to take a shot at. He drafted foundational guys because he knows he needs to build up the guts of the roster as well as get some stars on the top end. So, I mean, if I had to guess what their record would be this year, I think if they have a good year, not a great year, but a good year, they're a 500 team. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they're playing games that matter in December. You know, I mean, this might be finally a year without Tom Brady in the division where 9-7 makes the playoffs. You know, you don't know. It depends on who you beat in your division.
Right.
You know, it could come down to that. So, you know, I think that, you know, Adam Gase should be fired this year if they don't go 11-5 because we're done waiting. Well, yeah, but if you're a Jet fan, you could take that tact. But you're done waiting because you have lived through a John Idzik rebuild that didn't work. And you've lived through now a Mike Maccagnan rebuild that didn't work. Well, just because those rebuilds didn't work, I mean, by definition, if those rebuilds didn't work, you still have to let this regime rebuild. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. You're going to hold the coach responsible for the fact that he was left with a talent-free roster? I guess you can if you want. But no matter how many times the Jets change coaches over the years, doesn't seem to change the record. What changes the record, for the most part, are good players. And they just, you know, they need to go get more good players.
And I know you're a big golf fan and worked golf. Is that something you'd like to do more of going forward?
I love golf. Yeah, that would be a blast. You know, the two things that I really enjoy doing that you're hurt a little bit as being an ESPN guy, golf. ESPN has very little to no golf inventory. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to work the PGA, which would be great. We've kind of now, for the foreseeable future, I guess the next decade or so, we have become like the TNT of the first 2 rounds of the PGA. Mm-hmm. So our golf crew will go, and if we have a PGA, it's been bumped to the first week of August. Mm-hmm. If that happens, then I'll be out in San Francisco calling that for a couple of days, which will be great. But after that, you know, we don't really have any other golf mm-hmm. inventory. Mm-hmm. And then, and of course, college basketball.
Right.
You know, you're a college basketball guy. The hardest part about being at ESPN is you call all the games all year that are regular season. And then the minute the games become games that everybody in America cares about because they're filling out their bracket, all the guys at CBS and TNT that barely call any college basketball the whole year, they get to kind of come in and parachute in and call all the best games. But, mm-hmm. You know, it still allows me to go to places like Duke and Kansas and North Carolina and Oklahoma and places like that during the season. So it's not too bad.
Yeah, we know the hardest part of our jobs is juggling a sports work schedule, travel, and family. I always say that even though we're not there, we still have to be there. I know you've had a map in your house. Whose idea was the Where Is Daddy map?
Yeah, my wife put that up. When the kids were really little, because she thought it would actually be a way to, you know, teach them a little geography and also let them realize that I'm here, but I'm coming home. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the heart I tell people all the time. Every time I'm talking to a group of high schoolers or college kids about our business, so, you know, you get home, go to class or whatever, have your practice after school, have dinner with your family, go in and click on the television, and it's 7 o'clock at night, and you know, there's a Yankee game or a Kansas basketball game or, you know, an NBA game, Lakers, Clippers, or whatever. You see the announcers there, and you're like, oh, how great is that? Like, how awesome must that job be? And you know what? It is. It's a fun job. But we didn't all, like Star Trek, just beam ourselves there.
Right.
We've been there for a day or two. And that means that while you were with your family tonight having dinner at the dinner table, we were in a hotel room away from our families. So, like, I tell them all the time, if you want to see everything your kids do, go to recitals, go to games, be at the baseball game or the soccer field on a Saturday, and you know, you like your holidays, you like your family reunions, you like your bar mitzvahs and baptisms and all that kind of, all those kind of special things that happen in a family, this is not the job for you. Mm-hmm. If you do this job, you will miss those things. That's just, you know, if you're married and your wife and you get invited to a fall wedding, she's going alone because you're going to be at the game that you have to do. That's the job. So just be prepared that no matter how fun a job is, there's always going to be some sacrifice involved. And I would say 99% of the people that are in our business, they would say that that's the sacrifice. Family time, special occasions missed, missing what your kids do, all those kinds of things.
Do you have a favorite call or game that you've done?
Well, I mean, the one that jumps out probably is, you know, when the Jets went up to in 09 with the, you know, the Bart Scott mm-hmm. can't wait game, when they went up to New England and beat the Patriots as like a 3-touchdown underdog. I mean, that's, if there's one I would like to go back and watch again and call again, that one would be a lot of fun. But I have a terrible memory sometimes. You know, some guys just have a photographic memory. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed even when I'm listening to, like, you know, Chris Russo hosts a talk show or something, and he'll bring on Buck Showalter, and he'll talk about, like, the 95 Mariners-Yankees series, and he'll say, no, the turning point of that series, when you made that pitching change in, like, the fourth inning of game two, and I'll be like, there are times where I'll flip past ESPNU. They'll be, rebroadcasting a game, and I'll forget that I had called it until I hear my own voice. So just whatever wire doesn't fire in my brain to allow that kind of photographic memory that certain guys have, I just don't have it. But for a Jet Patriot game where the Jets were heading to the championship game, and you know, they no one expected them to win one of the all-time playoff upsets, that one's impossible to forget.
All right, Bob, before I let you go, through some of this, I've been trying to just give a little buzz to some small businesses during this difficult time. Is there any small businesses that you kind of want to mention or support during this time?
Yeah, I mean, all the restaurants. I live in Cranford, New Jersey, and we have an awesome downtown, and we've got a bunch of restaurants that if you're in the area, if you live in Union County, you probably already know that Cranford's a great place to visit, but all these restaurants are still open. So, you know, places like Kilkenny House and Mr. J's and River and Rail and Urban Burger, and we've got a lot of really fun places to go in town. And, you know, if anybody can swing through town and get a takeout order, that's what I've been trying to do with that GoFundMe, just to support the businesses. They're all trying to stay afloat.
That is tremendous. Well, Bob, I appreciate your time, and thanks for coming on, and stay safe, and good luck with your wife and everything else, and hopefully you're in a broadcast booth very soon.
From your lips to God's ears, get us out of all of this and let us go back to our lives. That would be great.
Exactly. Thanks again, Bob.
All right, man.
Seems like all the preparation and hard work has paid off for Bob. So happy to see all of his success. Stay tuned for the next episode of Mike Check on Sports. Take care. Brush your hair.